Welcome back, everybody, to the Cave of Solitude, your pop culture and comic book podcast, coming to you from the megacity metropolis of Toronto. I'm your host, Eric Anthony, and this is episode 219. And for the first time ever, I think my guest today is, it's a hat trick. It's an official hat trick of being on for the last three episodes, and that's none other than our good friend of the show, Mr. Sam Noir. Sam, thanks for coming back on and spending some time talking about fandom and comics and all the good stuff that we love. How's it going?
Oh, not too bad. Delighted to be back here. Looking forward to the conversation. We've got a few topics lined up that I'm anxious to chit-chat with you about.
Yeah. How's your week been? It's been one of those, with everything happening in 2020, we were talking about it before I pressed record, but we're officially in that 28-day lockdown now. Hopefully we'll be through this. Things will be different by Christmas time. But how's your week been since we last spoke?
To be honest, we had a bit of a situation at the house. I'll tell you about once we're off the air.
Okay.
But it's kind of a stressful situation. But on the flip side, it sort of forced us to move ahead with some home renovation projects, shall we say?
Yeah.
So I've been dealing with that for the last couple of days. But other than that, trying to get back with just work. So this is a good break from all that.
That's good. Yeah, we need. I took that month break from doing podcasting for a bit, but last week was a nice primer to get back into having just good old fashioned conversation with pals, where we can, talk about the things that make us happy. You need that, especially now when we can't see each other. I like being able to do this, and you and guys like Kev and Shane are always so easy to just strike up conversation with. So I'm always happy to have you guys on. This will be fun. Last week when we had Shane on, whenever Shane's on the podcast, I always tell him this: you don't like anything. You always want a podcast. I don't know why. You don't want to watch any movies, but he's always happy to podcast. So there was a couple of topics that me and you had intended to talk about and things that we had read that I really wanted to get your take on, because you, you're one of the most well-read creators in the community, but also just in fandom. I love being able to pick your brain. What have you read recently that you would recommend to me, or just stuff that you want to talk about? I'm thinking of Jimmy Olsen, top of my head. I'm seeing it on my shelf. Did you read that?
Yeah. No, I read it monthly, and actually that was a really great experience in terms of a book that, I will like to read it all at once, but the monthly experience actually was kind of fun given the nature, and we can go a little deeper into Jimmy Olsen in a bit. But I think last week I recommended Friday by Ed Brubaker and Marcos Martin on Panel Syndicate.
Right. I never got a chance to read that. Panel Syndicate.
Yeah. It's basically a wonderful, I believe it's run by Brian K. Vaughan and Marcos Martin, I believe. And yeah, it's a great pay what you can model of comics. And that's where I think I mentioned The Private Eye first ran, and what else? The Walking Dead, The Alien, Brian K. Vaughan and Marcos one-shot Walking Dead, the first time that Kirkman let anyone else do something in the Walking Dead universe. And we actually, without spoiling too much, we got to see for the first time how the zombie apocalypse looks on another part of the planet, shall we say. And what else was on there? Barrier, Brian K. Vaughan's Barrier. And both The Private Eye and Barrier, I think, were in that kind of widescreen format, so quite innovative. But Friday is sort of a traditional size comic book. I think I described it last week as what happens when Encyclopedia Brown grows up. Has to deal with sort of a lot of adult things, including adult relationships. So I've been whenever I know Brubaker's been busy sort of in other realms in terms of writing television, et cetera, but whenever one of his comic book projects drops, during the pandemic, I did a big read through of all his creator-owned crime stuff, because I did read a lot of it monthly, but I think it sort of loses a lot of impact rather than reading everything back to back. And yeah, it criminal, fatal. I'm trying to think of what else. Kill or Be Killed. Yeah, all of these, reading them in sort of one shot as my sort of pandemic lockdown reading was wonderful. So Pulp dropped a couple of months ago, I think, which is another great graphic novella that I recommend. And then, yeah, Friday was a surprise to me because it didn't hit comic shop. So luckily I subscribed to Ed Brubaker's newsletter and got to hear about it then. And you can't beat pay what you can. That's the great thing. So what a brilliant model that is. I recommend folks go to Panel Syndicate and check out those books.
So would you, when it comes to Brubaker, now that you bring up his name, do you prefer all his creator-owned work as opposed to the stuff he did for the main big two, for instance? Can you hear me, Sam?
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. Okay. Yeah, you broke up just for a little bit, but I do recommend, for me personally, I don't love his run on, you know, Captain America, and I thought his X-Men run was a great deal of fun, and creating the Winter Soldier and sort of scripting, I can't remember how long that series ran, but that was sort of quite an enjoyable run. But I think as a reader, I really, really like when he is making his own stuff. And that's how he started off as well. He actually wrote and drew his own stuff. And actually, it was sort of a cross between autobiographical and crime stuff. It was called Low Life.
Okay, yeah, I think I've seen that on the shelf.
Yeah. And you do kind of get to see sort of that early Brubaker. And then I did kind of read a lot of his early Vertigo stuff, like Scene of the Crime. And then I'm trying to remember, it was about scooter culture, like a sort of near future scooter culture. Dead Enders. I think it was called Dead Enders, which was another really good series. And then, yeah, I thought, oh, I usually when, you know, people who are more sort of Vertigo creators, as I call them, jump over to mainstream superhero stuff, I generally, you know, it's okay, but I prefer their creator's own stuff. I did love all of that, but what a joy it was when he jumped back over to, especially crime and noir. That seems to be really his specialty, and all the sort of variations story, like the criminal in terms of this whole world he's created with intertwining characters across decades is quite fantastic. And, or even when he weaves in horror elements. So Fatal was wonderful because it was sort of Lovecraftian noir. Or Kill or Be Killed was his take on the vigilante genre with potential supernatural elements that may or may not be there, which is, I think there's an ambiguity to a lot of his creator-owned work that really, really works well, especially in that gray area of crime that he likes to deal in.
Yeah, I gotta dig into Ed Brubaker's creator-owned stuff, because I've only heard the highest of praise for it. I've read a lot of his, you know, his Cap run, obviously, Gotham Central, you know, numerous things that he's done for the big two, and I've enjoyed much of it. But I know that him and Sean Phillips specifically are you know, heralded as that 1-2 punch that you can never really go wrong with. Do you find with modern day storytelling that you enjoy, because you brought up Jimmy Olsen reading it monthly, but do you find that you enjoy reading in the chunks more with the way that comics are made today or the way the stories are laid out?
I think it all depends on the creator, and often sort of the lighter and fluffier something can be, and Jimmy Olsen, I think, definitely sort of fits in that. I like sort of that burst of entertainment. You know, in a lot of ways, there was a movement a few years ago where they call, I think it term might have originated out of the Warren Ellis Forum, where a lot of creators hung out, but there was this term, and Matt Fraction, of course, was one of the creators that came out of the Warren Ellis Forum, but there was this movement called pop comics, where, you know, you sort of indulged in the pop culture fluffiness of it. It didn't have to necessarily be Mouse, but it was entertaining in its sort of monthly pamphlet installments. And I think Jimmy Olsen fit that mold. Not only that, but once it finished and collected, you realized after the fact that what seemed to be sort of a fairly random series of humorous vignettes all tied together beautifully in one coherent storyline. So I enjoyed it on one level in terms of here's a bunch of funny scenes, almost like an anthology. And I don't know if are you familiar with Jimmy Olsen's like 1950s run in particular?
No.
His comics, I think, when the Comics Code came in and all the horror comics sort of went away and sort of they tried to sort of tone everything down. Comics like Superman's girlfriend Lois Lane and Jimmy Olsen ran for something crazy like 200 issues from like the 1950s through the 1970s when Jack Kirby sort of took it over, and then eventually it was finally canceled. But Jimmy Olsen's 1950 stuff, the stuff you're seeing Matt Fraction and I believe is it Steve Lieber who drew it, the artist of what's the snow thriller? Whiteout. They're not far off from the formula of those gonzo Mort Weisinger 1950s Jimmy Olsen stories where, Jimmy Olsen sort of goes in and all sorts of madcap crazy things happen to him.
Yeah.
So I think you've noticed, obviously, a lot of the sort of because it's presented as a series of short stories, right? Within the comic, even though there's sort of one coherent story. And then there's a lot of sort of the, this is a story about the long text that introduces each story.
Yeah.
This is Jimmy Olsen's best friend, Superman's pal, Jimmy Olsen, blah, 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 blah. All of that was a hallmark of the 1950s. So there's two levels of enjoyment in terms of the kitsch and the camp, but once the pieces fall together, it's kind of brilliant and bravura work on the part of Fraction. Like Fraction has really, really become quite a brilliant structuralist, I think is sort of a good term in terms of creating story structure where you don't necessarily see it. He's pushed the envelope actually with some of the experimentation he's done in Jimmy Olsen. Is it published by Image Comics? I think it's called November. But there's sort of a series of three graphic novellas in sort of the crime, thriller, terrorism, conspiracy genre that seems to be separate vignettes that ultimately, as the series goes on, they all sort of tie together into one story. So it felt like Jimmy Olsen was kind of the runway for something a little more serious and complex in what I want to call November. And I'm just going to sort of quickly Google that to make sure I got the name. What did you think of Jimmy Olsen?
I kept hearing people talk about it on other podcasts and saying how it was real wacky. And, is it just me or is it really weird and we don't know what's going on? And I was like, I was really excited for this book because I like the creative team on it. I thought I get excited when I see that it's going to be a maxi series. Like it's been decided this story is going to be told in 12 parts. So you know that the creator has, their beginning, middle, and end. There's somewhat of a finite thing to it. So you're going to enjoy whether it's monthly or when you collect it all. I was looking forward to that, but I was like, I don't know. Maybe I just got to wait for this one to be collected all together. And as I was reading it, it was wacky. And I did understand why people were saying that, but I did find what you commented on, that those short stories. Sometimes it was one page or two pages of telling you a portion of the story that wasn't necessarily in order. And I kind of felt like I could hear the voice in my head. The voice I heard was from Batman 66, where, what's this? You know,
what's, you know, absolutely,
you know, and I was reading it to myself in that voice to make it fun and make it campy. But when it all came together and you saw, you know, the plot, it wasn't reading it in the book, in the graphic novel of where everything's collected. I kind of had an idea of what it could be, but it was still done. It still threw me for a loop in the end where they connected the family, the you know, the Metropolis history and the families there. And there were layers about the Olsen family. I'm like, I had no idea that the Olsen family had this much rich history within Metropolis, and what their, you know, the rivalry that the Olsens had with the Luthers through, you know, I don't know how many decades there were, but at least a century's worth of feuding between these two families to try to take over or influence Metropolis. So I thought that was really cool, seeing Jimmy with siblings, because I grew up on, you know, the John Byrne era of post-crisis Superman, and I remember Jimmy Olsen and his mother and his father being, if I remember correctly, a spy, like a CIA agent of some kind that he never really got to know well enough. So I didn't know that, like, this is obviously, like you said, a take back, bringing it back to the 50s hijinks and silliness of Jimmy Olsen.
And this is all sort of created whole cloth by Fraction as well. I sort of, because again, my memories of sort of the 1950s comics were basically, because it's the more outrageous stuff that sticks out, you know, the turtle, Jimmy Olsen turning into a turtle, or, you know, Mort Weisinger had this thing for apes. Like, he was convinced that putting an ape on the cover automatically sold, like, you know, more comics that way.
I heard
but,
that, yeah.
Matt Fraction actually created a lot of this backstory, and the two sibling characters are all new characters, I guess, that sort of fit into this new DC rebirth Bendis era of Superman. So on the one hand, even though it felt like sort of him drawing on past Olsen history, it's actually, and again, this is sort of the fun part about being part of a reboot, I guess, where you can sort of ignore continuity and create a story like this and create a history. And it's really cool, actually, in terms of the sibling dynamics that come out over time amidst humorous situations. At first, his brother is merely sort of the stuffed shirt that, you know, he plays up against, and then his sister sort of as his partner in crime, you know, and then even going out there, remember the Peanuts sequence in that sort of Charles M. Schulz? They went into this Charles M. Schulz style, which has become a little bit of a trope in comics. Everyone at one point, amidst their, you know, serious superhero comic, has sort of done a Peanuts pastiche. I think Savage Dragon did it a couple of months ago.
Okay.
But it's just taking all these elements, or even the more absurd elements of recent DC history that were played completely straight and serious, him able to lampoon that, the serious Batman, and them getting into a practical joke war with each other.
That was good.
For me, the best bits, the running bit actually was the what's his name, Dexter, the Red Lantern cat.
Oh, right.
Who was a big part of the Geoff Johns. I think he's a Geoff Johns creation, right? Dexter in Green Lantern. But yeah, the fact that this sort of cat shows up, you don't know who this cat is, and then it just starts vomiting blood all over the place, and then it becomes a running gag through the entire comic, you know? And the thing is, no matter how many times this cat shows up, I found myself laughing out loud. And amidst a pandemic, you know, what a great thing it is to have a humor comic.
Yeah. Yeah, no,
you know,
that's
something
true.
That genuinely makes me laugh. And I'm always sort of looking for that humor comic. And in some ways, I was hoping a couple of years ago, there was a recent Bizarro comic that sort of paired Jimmy Olsen up with Bizarro, which I liked, but I didn't love, and I didn't laugh out loud to the point that I did. I think I was hoping that Bizarro comic would be Jimmy Olsen, and I wasn't expecting Jimmy Olsen actually to be this funny.
Yeah.
Justice League, Giffen and DeMatteis's Justice League. There's enough sort of pathos in there, sort of, to and relationships to make it real for you and entertaining.
Yeah, that was that Justice League run from DeMatteis and Giffen was quite the feat. Seeing how you take such a you know, serious team and still make them have rich story and issues to deal with, but finding ways to put in the humor into that book that doesn't cheapen the team. It was very well done how they did that. It was a balancing act that I don't think many people can do. And it's something to look back on and actually, you know, really see the inner workings of it. It's a tough trick to pull off.
I did a recent sort of flip. I didn't do a complete reread, but I did do sort of a flip through, and I had forgotten, because in your mind, it was a really funny series and the focus was on humor, but it actually wasn't. Humor was just sort of like the Avengers movies. Humor was just sort of one flavor that they sort of mixed in there. And just because, you know, you tend to forget sort of some of the life and death situations that the creative team put them through. Like they were put through the ringer on a number of occasions, even though, you know, they might have three or four issue dramatic arc where Despero, you know, just takes out the team. But then you'll have like that one off where Guy Gardner and Ice go on a date. You know what I mean? So I think Fraction and Lieber have really found a wonderful balance, and I think containing it to that 12 issues and making it all sort of tie together on they stuck the landing.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if we talked about Lois Lane.
No.
That ran sort of parallel.
I was
going to
ask you about that. What are you thinking of, you know, that the Bendis sort of era of Superman? And I want to get your take on Lois Lane, because I haven't read that myself.
I'll be honest. I have fallen way behind. I think when Bendis sort of first landed on Man of Steel, I read the first bunch of issues, and I might have read the first couple of issues when he first started, but then I sort of fell behind on it. I liked it, but then it didn't sort of necessarily hook me right away. What Bendis seemed to get right, and again, I think this is because of his background in journalism, I think he really got the newsroom right. And for me, I was even more than Jimmy Olsen, because I kind of saw Jimmy Olsen as light, fluffy entertainment that I'd flip through every month. But then Lois Lane was coming in, and it had a wonderful creative team. Greg Rucka, who I really, really like as a writer. And I can't remember the name of the artist, but I really like the artist on Lois Lane as well. And
it's not Michael Lark, is it? Because I know they work together often. Greg Rucka and Michael Lark worked together, but I don't think
It definitely wasn't Michael Lark, because I would have remembered, because I'm a big fan of Michael Lark. But yeah, the art was actually really, we can sort of Google this as we go along, but just sort of comparing the two, I went in really, really invested, because Rucka does a great job defining Lois Lane as a very sort of strong, capable character. He comes up with really good explanations as to why, you know, why doesn't she just call Superman to solve all her problems? You know, but this is something that she excels at, investigative journalism. And she's actually, I'm trying to remember...
The artist is Mike Perkins.
Okay, yes. Perkins did a phenomenal job drawing the series. It is a beautiful one of for 12 consistent issues of art. And the other thing is Lois was also paired off with Rucka's version of The Question, Renee Montoya.
Okay.
Which, again, I was a big fan of his version from, I think, the series 52. And then she had sort of... what was it, a 5-issue miniseries that he wrote, and then appeared in Batwoman. I think she was a supporting character in Rucka's J.H. Williams' version of Batwoman. But to see sort of Lois and Montoya sort of off on an adventure, and, oh, God, how how much am I going to go into spoiler territory in terms of discussing what didn't work for me with Lois Lane?
Oh, you can say whatever you like. I haven't read it, so
okay.
I mean, if you didn't, just don't spoil, I guess, the whole story. But you can be free to tell me what you like and what you don't like, or what works and what doesn't work. No problem.
Yeah. So the buildup was phenomenal. Like, I'm invested. I'm on board. The storyline's, like, engaging. The tension is mounting with this issue. And then, essentially, the sort of, it was the conclusion that I sort of had issues with, because it doesn't really – I would have preferred it to be like Jimmy Olsen in that, wow – this really stood well on its own, because that's the direction it was headed. And then that sort of final, you know, whatever it was, three, four issues. I can't remember, how the issues broke down. They went meta in that Superboy Punch kind of thing. Do you know what I'm saying about Superboy Punch?
In the Infinite Crisis story, yeah, where they try to mess around with reality.
Yeah, they went sort of off in that direction, and Perkins, again, did a beautiful job illustrating, you know, crisis seas and multiple Earths and things like that, but it just didn't seem to fit in this wonderfully, wonderfully grounded series, and to be honest, I hadn't been really following the last two reboots too closely in terms of the New 52 followed by Rebirth, so I wasn't really emotionally invested in any of the sort of changes. I just wanted to read a good standalone story, and then the fact that they kind of went there tore me right out of the story, tore me right out of sort of the engagement with the characters, because you're just basically, it's the continuity patches, right? It's the problem with the post-original Crisis on Infinite Earths DCU, where storylines would conflict with each other, and then they'd have to do somersaults, basically, to explain why the Legion of Superheroes was still around when Superboy, you know, wasn't. And really, you didn't need to go there, was sort of my opinion. But otherwise, well-crafted. Like, Lois Lane was beautifully well-crafted. It just didn't work for me. And that's why, even more, like, reading the two series in parallel, because they were coming out, like, literally at the same time and ended at the same time, I was shocked, to be honest, because I was all in with Lois Lane, and I thought, oh, there's no way they wouldn't stick the landing after such a well-crafted sort of setup, and then it turned out to be opposite. Jimmy Olsen turned out to be the one that surprised me and managed to sort of dovetail into something that I found genuinely clever as sort of the writing craft.
Right. Do you find, especially more recently, that the better storytelling coming from DC is out of continuity, this black label sort of approach that they're taking to being a little bit more adult, a little bit more risque, if you will, and just telling a story that they want to tell regardless of what may be happening in main publishing area? Because I think you're right. For me, I don't mind multiverses and those type of things, but I feel DC, like you said, it was a the way you put it was just right. Somersaulting, always trying to, you know, course correct, and it gets to the point where, okay, just let Dr. Manhattan be the one messing with everything. It's almost like the easy solution to it. But do you find that the out of continuity story is DC's best sort of stuff?
Absolutely, and I think DC itself, like I think when Dan DiDio first came on board DC, I think, or it might have been, was it Dan DiDio that came on board? Whenever there was sort of a main changing of the guard between Levitz and, Paul Levitz, and I think it was the Dan DiDio transition, there was a question. It's like, why are all the best DC stories, the classic ones, set in Elseworlds? Why does it sort of exist in that imprint? And I think DiDio tried to do his best to make all stories count and all stories matter, but with mixed results, because fans really want that continuity, and creators, you know, any creator interview you've sort of read or listened to will say the reason why Elseworlds are so powerful is because you get an ending. You're allowed to craft, you know, it's not just one big middle section. You're allowed in within a storyline to do a beginning, middle, and end. That's why Dark Knight is so strong, Superman Red Sun, you know. More recently, a lot of these things that are elsewhere. Is it Last Night on Earth was quite enjoyable because it's out of continuity. I think Harleen was another Black Label that I enjoyed. Yeah, so I think Black Label, you're absolutely right. Black Label... when they aren't sort of dealing with continuity issues, are pretty much the books I've been picking up because I don't have to deal with a lot of baggage that I haven't been following. Okay. Which, again, both of us like Doomsday Clock, for example.
I did. I enjoyed it.
I think for me, a lot of it was once they went into sort of the continuity fixing realm. It didn't quite work for me.
Yeah, I mean, I was anticipating that because when Rebirth was launched and they had that big poster, they had the button, they had the big, there was that poster of Rebirth where you saw all of the DC Universe reaching out in that sort of, I forgot the classic artist who drew the, you know, the hand of God touch with the finger. Who was that? Was that Michelangelo who drew that?
Oh, yeah, sort of the creator and God created man.
Right. So there was that sort
Sistine
of...
Chapel, the Sistine Chapel.
The motif of that was kind of being redone in the Rebirth launch, and it showed like just a hand, and Superman was reaching out to it. And I kind of guessed they're going to go somewhere with Dr. Manhattan. And I thought that was kind of cool that it was a way to bring back... Whatever New 52 had taken away, this was an interesting way to explain it. But to see how they made it explain the whole history was like, okay. I didn't mind the story myself because I'm a Geoff Johns fan.
Me too.
Maybe a little bit more biasly than I should be, but he's one of my favorite writers of all time. So I'm a little bit biased when I approach his stories because I feel that he writes these characters with the intent of making whatever's not working with them work and with a sense of love. And some people may not like, oh, you bring him back, you know, Hal Jordan and you took away Kyle and you bring him back Barry and we all love Wally. But whatever he's doing, I feel like he's doing because he cares about the characters in some way. So I kind of give it a pass. But speaking of the Black Label... another example is, you know, Three Jokers.
Mm-hmm.
And you had brought up the... I hadn't finished reading the series when you mentioned it last week because you wanted to get my take on it about does it work if you haven't read The Killing Joke? And I think it can, but it also...
Death in the Family as well.
Or Death in the Family. Yes, absolutely right. I think it can because it's such a good-looking book and... The story is intriguing because it's the Joker, so people are drawn to it, but it'll make people say, I got to read the other one now. It's kind of one of those sequels that make you watch the first one.
Yeah, or you do that thing that I always do with certain TV shows that you run to YouTube to sort of get the things you missed. The Mandalorian this week, you know, you whatever sort of Easter egg. So, I mean, I'm you know, having been steeped in Batman history, I sort of recognize which three Jokers and where each of these sort of three Jokers appeared. So you do sort of have the earliest version of the Joker, who's sort of the criminal, and then you have the clown, who was the laughing fish Joker, as well as the Joker who with the crowbar, who killed Jason Todd. And then sort of the more contemporary Joker was obviously sort of the Killing Joke, let's say through to close to present day, is sort of the Brian Boland, Alan Moore Joker that tended to sort of dominate. But you could also say at any point that you know, whatever story came out could fit with any of these Jokers. And even the ones that didn't quite fit, like for me, you know, which Joker was the one that had his face stapled back on? And that could have been one of the failed Joker experiments, for example. You know, the ones that don't quite fit in with these three,
right?
You could sort of offer that. And that's partly the good thing Geoff Johns did. He did leave a lot of things ambiguous and didn't necessarily state outright, other than the fact that I think the clown bludgeoned Jason Todd to death. We're in spoiler territory, right? We can talk spoilers.
Spoiler away. Folks, spoilers are coming. So if you want to skip ahead, skip ahead.
So yeah, the clown obviously bludgeoned Jason to death. The Boland, the comedian was obviously the one who shot Barbara Gordon and crippled her. And sort of the original, I'm doing finger quotes, criminal, crime boss Joker that you saw sort of in the earliest days of Batman.
Yeah. I feel like it kind of did the same sort of thing that, maybe this is a bad comparison, but it would work in the same way as a person reading Grant Morrison Batman. I feel like when you read Grant Morrison Batman, you have to realize that he is giving, I don't know what the proper term would be, but all of the Batmans that you think you've known are all Batman. They're all in continuity. So 66 Batman is that Batman. 89 Batman, whichever one you have attached yourself to, he lived through all of that. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to read Grant Morrison, you have to think in those terms.
That and even
all of it counts.
The brilliance of, was it the, I can't remember, the colorful Batman of Zen, the planet Zen-La or whatever?
Zurin-Ra, something like that.
He retconned as an alternate personality if he was emotionally traumatized enough to get out of function as sort of a hidden personality he programmed into himself in case of emergency, I think was actually quite a brilliant, or Batmite.
Right.
When Batmite showed up, like me being sort of an old school Batmite fan because of the new adventures of the Batman in Filmation that did this. So anytime Batmite shows up, I'm down with it.
Yeah. See, reading Grant Morrison monthly was really good until we got into RIP and I said, I'm missing something. Like, I don't understand this Grant Morrison now. When he was doing, you know, mm-hmm. Batman and Son, and you know the black glove and all of that stuff, I understood pretty much straightforward the storytelling that we're getting, the action adventure. And then when he got into the layers and a lot of the, you know, the symbolism of what was drawn and how petals were falling into, you know, a checkered floor, I'm like, I'm missing something here. I don't understand
the levels of reality. And once Morrison has hooked you, I think he felt like, okay, now I can get into my shamanism. Like, this
right.
is him working his version of comics magic, I guess, and then the metaphysics of it.
Yeah, and I really love, I at the time when I was reading that, I didn't get it. But now, a little bit more older and, you know, having read different things, now I really look forward to those things in a different way. I think mm-hmm. I think like I've caught up to where I can appreciate it, whereas before. So with getting back to the three Jokers, I agree with you. I like that Geoff Johns left it ambiguous, but I was still at the end wondering what was the point of this story, and I was wondering if you would be able to explain that to me, because I don't know if it needed to be told. Not that any, you know, Batman story now needs to be told, but in this mm-hmm. case, it was built up from the button. Where you
yeah.
had, you know, there's three of them, and mm-hmm. you were going to have some sort of a revelation and explanation. Because you make a good point about the staple-faced Joker from the Snyder story and the Morrison Joker. They're evolutions, but they also feel they're trying to more adapt what's in the comics to what we've seen in the movies.
Mm-hmm. And Morrison's take was just like Batman's take in terms of, you know, every time you see a different version, because he explained it in Arkham Asylum, every time you see a different version of the Joker, it's just sort of him manifesting, this is modern life. Like, he's sort of he's malleable in this place. Cause, so this is why he's, at one point, he's a complete psychotic, and another, he's just a harmless clown. So Morrison's take was that, again, just like every Batman is Batman, every Joker is Joker. And, he set it up sort of that way versus Jeff Johns, who likes to kind of let's try to explain things a little bit, you know, which again gets a lot of points for being clever, and the fact that he did sort of see an opening in the Killing Joke to have a interesting ending, especially giving Bruce back a lot of power that might have been taken away somewhat in the Killing Joke as a character, he's never figured out who the Joker is. We're in spoiler territory, right?
Yes, yes.
I am Batman. Of course I knew who the Joker was within the week after he first showed up, and then sort of giving a good enough sort of explanation why it doesn't really matter who the Joker is. So he sort of had some fun with it. I can see Jeff Johns having a lot of fun. It's kind of fortunate that it's a Black Label thing, because you can say it's out of continuity. And man, you got to admire Fabok for, he's his own artist. He's his own style, obviously. And it's, the art is beautiful. But the fact that he is able to evoke so many eras of Batman artists. He's not doing a Boland impression, but, you know, by golly, he's sort of nailed Brian Boland's version in his own style, or Marshall Rogers, who drew Death in the Family. Jim, that sort of Marshall Rogers, Jim Aparo kind of era of Batman, he's sort of hit that, or even the early sort of Bob Kane, Jerry Robinson, Dick Sprang version of The Man Who Laughs, their sort of version taken from the black and white movie.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was called Conrad. Who's the actor? Conrad Veidt or something?
Yeah, I think you're right.
That was a heavy influence, but you can kind of squint your eyes and see that version in the Criminal Joker. So yeah, both creators working at the top of their game. You cannot help but admire the sheer craft of not only three Jokers, but Doomsday Clock as well. There is a lot of craft involved. But on the flip side, as we said with Doomsday Clock, there's elements that sort of didn't work for me, especially sort of that Superman punch or Superboy punch kind of explanation, right? Oh, anything that sort of doesn't fit in continuity, it was Dr. Manhattan. Mm-hmm. All right. But did we sort of need that, or can we just sort of move on with our lives and just sort of ignore all the continuity things rather than create a whole story around it, especially a Watchmen sequel?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And we touched on this last week. It's like, as much as I liked it, I like the TV show better because it's a self-contained story that has something to say other than being meta or a launching point for other series or other ideas.
Right. You know? Yes. Yes. I like both. I like both of those concepts where you can make something, like you said, meta and that launching point, but man, I cannot sing the praises enough of that television series and how the not the conceit, but for the creator of that show to say, that's my story. I'm not trying to cash in on the fact that this was good and we're just going to keep, you know, doing this until it sucks, which is what happens with a lot of shows, right? They do it until, okay, if we do anything more, the whole thing's going to fall apart. He said, this is my story and it's complete, and you feel it. You feel like it's such a good sequel to what we concluded with the last one. Even what they did with Dr. Manhattan, it completely threw me for a loop. I did not expect those things. And mm-hmm. that episode where he, you know, does his thing, shows up, and it was, I loved it. I could just watch that again and again. I love that chicken and the egg sort of.
Oh, absolutely.
I love that. Drives me crazy, and I love it.
Not that that I don't get Shane's point. Like, I think Shane honestly has a point. It can be the most well-crafted thing, but if you sort of draw a line in the sand in terms of, you know, Alan Moore did feel cheated, and within the context, like, by the letter of the law, he might not have been cheated, but the spirit of the contract was that he was going to get that property back because nothing had stayed in print for like 30, 40 years prior to that. Comics always, you know, in the 1980s went out of print. So I'll agree with that, but I can't help but see something so well crafted that, I'm willing to sort of consume it. All the same. And Rorschach actually, another issue I think dropped between the time we talked about it last week, I think.
Okay.
How much did we talk about Rorschach last week?
I don't think we talked about it at all.
Oh, okay. Boy, you haven't read it at all, eh?
I'm a binge reader now, where I like to get things in collected format and just for space and for the reading experience. So there's a lot of stuff that will hit shelves in floppy that I'll be behind nowadays. So yeah. Is it holding? I love Tom King in maxi series format. Like, I would say maybe my favorite thing from him. I know everyone's huge on The Vision, and that was fantastic, but I really enjoyed Mr. Miracle. I thought that was amazing.
My top three are all sort of within his 12 issue realm. Although I think, Vision, Mr. Miracle, and Sheriff of Babylon, I think, was designed to continue. So even though it's a really well crafted 12 issues, I'm really hoping at some point he does return to his former Vertigo series, Sheriff of Babylon. But yeah,
and I loved Omega Men. I thought Omega Men was very underrated.
Mm-hmm. No, definitely, definitely. Rorschach, again, I would probably love to read it all at once, but I'm too excited by the series to wait. And so, yeah, again, it's unbearable to me to sort of get it piecemeal. But he is doing some really cool stuff. It's meta, but not in sort of the Geoff Johns kind of way. There's a lot of Ditko in this. Obviously, you know, Ditko was the creator of The Question that the Rorschach is based on. There's a lot of even as a character, there might be sort of a Ditko avatar, shall we say, in the series. So yeah, I'm not going to go any further than that, but I cannot wait for, let's say, 10 months from now, when this thing is collected and you've read it, for us to have this conversation about Rorschach.
Okay.
Because I think we could have a very, very sort of cool conversation around this. And actually, even Strange Adventures. We're about halfway through Strange Adventures. And once that's collected, I'd really, really like to hear your thoughts on that.
What do you think of his ability to tell great stories in that 12 issue maxi series format? And I know a lot of people love his Batman, and some people were irritated with it. I don't know if you had read his Batman. I thought it was good.
I liked it.
But there, it was one of those things again where I felt 100 issues of Tom King telling this long form Batman story, I feel he would have nailed it, knocked it out the park in 12. There's just something about him that. Stick to the 12 issue format. Not to say that I don't want you on something for longer. It's just he excels so well at that. What do you think that is for certain creators that they need a lot of runway, and some people need that, you know, parking lot to work in, and they can just create an amusement park.
Yeah. Not that Tom King hasn't had good sort of one issue series, but I think 12 issues, because a lot of it is psychological and a lot of it is sort of building up a certain degree of ambiguity for that character to exist in. If we're going to try to find certain themes in Tom King's work. And I think he sort of trades in that, and there is a lot of sort of push and pull with the audience as they're sort of relating to these characters, and then having the rug pulled out from under them as well, in terms of certain expectations set up with the characters. And then your expectations are, uh, uh, yeah, uh, uh, foil in certain ways and in an emotional kind of manner, which is good writing. Like, this is sort of his intentions with Mr. Miracle. And I love the fact that even more than Vision, Mr. Miracle is very ambiguous in this ending, but you get the theme. Like, as a family person trying to sort of balance out, I guess, his responsibility and his life as a new god with this sense of normalcy that he's trying to build around himself, and which is the trap, you know, which part of his life is the trap and what's he trying to escape from, yeah. You know, and all of that is left open, which is phenomenal. You know, you're also left with the question of, everyone loves to ask, how does this fit in with the current continuity? And the answer is, it isn't. And maybe this is something that, you know, this is the trap that Mr. Miracle doesn't want to escape from.
Yeah. There was a scene in that book or that series where Orion approaches him and puts him on trial. And I don't remember all of the details of it, but the line of questioning he asks him, how he entraps him to, you know, concede his guilt. It was such an interesting way of being written. Mm-hmm. I love going back to that series. It's one of those ones I could reread every so often just to get another layer of that story and mm-hmm. the psychology behind it. Because I feel Tom King often says, you know, he being a family man and someone who's, you know, very in love with his wife and sees her as his compass, anchor. His anchor, yeah, his North Star, because of his own experiences having been in the CIA and having maybe some sort of post-traumatic stress of things that maybe he's seen, he always kind of mm-hmm. writes a love story. He revolves mm-hmm. his stories around some sort of connection to somebody and what mm-hmm. what they'll be willing to do and sacrifice for that. And I love the different angles he does with the Vision, and then he does it with Mr. Miracle, with Barda and Scott. And I'll be interesting to see what he does with he tried to do with Batman and Catwoman as well. I still think that story needs to be completed. So it's interesting how he always takes that sort of coupling, that mm-hmm. love theme throughout his books.
Do you have an interpretation for Mr. Miracle? Are you okay with sort of leaving it within that sort of ambiguous space?
I like leaving it in ambiguous space where you can, it's just like kind of the three Jokers where I was mm-hmm. who's it going to be, which, and I feel that I could be wrong, maybe in my head the real Joker was the comedian who, you know, fell into the acid and spoilers, he thought his wife died, but she actually is in like a witness protection program. In my head, I'm like, that mm-hmm. that's the real Joker, the one from The Killing Joke. That's the real Joker.
Yeah.
But again, the existence of those other ones, it's like, that's the only way the Joker could do what he does is if there's more than one, because so many mm-hmm. times one of them has died and you don't know where he went. Right. That's always kind of been mm-hmm. they've never explained those aspects. So I like the ambiguity of it, and that you don't get a name. Like, that's perfect. Because mm-hmm. it leaves it, it doesn't ruin anything. It doesn't put anything set in stone where it's like, oh, his name is Jack Napier. It's like, oh, finally. Yeah. Like, I like that.
Well, it is good to have that multiple choice interpretive ending in terms of, I think this is why people to this day are still talking about the TV show The Prisoner.
Okay.
You know, it's such a trippy, and you can draw parallels actually with Mr. Miracle and The Prisoner in terms of the premise of that show being someone trying to escape an island. He's an ex-spy trying to escape an island, and yeah, there's sort of a twist ending that is completely open to interpretation, and it sort of becomes more psychological, and again, we're using this word a lot, but metaphysical, than an actual, like, this is the ending. And I think this is the brilliance of Mr. Miracle. He's sort of given us enough for us to have that conversation with Tom King and what's the artist's name again? Mitch Gerrits?
Yes. Yes.
Mitch Garrett, and they've crafted enough that it sort of becomes a dialogue with the audience. And at the end of the day, does it really matter? Is the trap sort of in his head? And, you know, is it a happy ending? Is it a happy ending for the pre-crisis Mr. Miracle? I like that interpretation, where basically he's sort of pulled out of continuity and has his own sort of pocket of happiness and then happily ever after. Because I know a lot of fans, because again, I haven't followed the New 52, but apparently that version of Mr. Miracle didn't line up with the New 52 version that they had introduced. So it's nice that way, you know, and again, stands outside of continuity. You read it how you will. Vision actually, for me, I think is more, despite the psychology of a lot of it, it was a lot more plot driven. So this is kind of a fascination comparing the two. A lot of it does have to do with sort of twists and turns in the plot versus the inner life of Mr. Miracle, you know, and the story told from Mr. Miracle's point of view in terms of questioning what's real and what's not real.
Yeah. What do you feel about the New Gods as a whole, as a concept? Because I know for Kirby, it was his way of kind of continuing whatever story he may have wanted to do with Thor and you know, the Nine Realms, and he goes over to DC and he kind of creates his whole new mythology, which I think is incredible. What is your take on the New Gods?
I'm mostly a fan of, I like the New Gods, but I'm mostly a fan of Mr. Miracle. And I think the reason for that is he is the most grounded character. He is kind of the most relatable character. He's the character who sort of comes to Earth and wants to live a normal life away from sort of the epicness of Orion and the intrigues and the you know, never-ending war between good and evil and the two planets. That was always sort of my access to the New Gods characters. So I was a fan of the original run of Kirby, because it was always, any of Kirby's 70s stuff always was kind of weird and almost scary to me when I ran across it. His when he came back to Captain America, you know, it just didn't look like any other, that chunkiness, the Kirby lines, you know, the machinery, it just didn't look like any other art. So when I ran across like the Demon or Devil Dinosaur or Mr. Miracle, I kind of was really drawn, because I actually like sort of these oddball characters as well. And when Mr. Miracle joined the Justice League, that was fantastic. And again, that was sort of my access to the New Gods characters. I haven't really, like, I've sampled them, but there's Byrne's run, there's Simonson's run, which from what I've sampled, I've enjoyed them enough, but not enough to sort of continue and go too deep on them.
Yeah. Simonson's Orion run, I really enjoyed quite a bit. I want to read John Byrne's. It's coming out in omnibus form next summer, which I'm excited for, because I don't think it's ever been really collected in any kind of concise format. So I know that there was some sort of, at the same time of Simonson, they were kind of overlapping each other a little bit. So I'm looking forward to reading what Byrne, because I know he's a huge Kirby fan, and
yes,
both of them are. And they both have their own art styles, which kind of pay homage to Kirby in their own way, whether it's John Byrne's detail in machinery. And when you look at a Fantastic Four page and just see all the details that he puts into something, or in Simonson's sort of blockiness, that Kirby structure that you were describing. So I like seeing artists pay their homage and respect to an influence, but I've never read John Byrne's version on it. So I'm excited for that.
I actually kind of did enjoy Byrne's version of the Demon from that era. I think, what was it, the late 90s or something like that? Was when he was doing both the New Gods and Demon and Wonder Woman, I think that period. So I would be curious. Like, let me know what you think of John Byrne's New Gods. I know, was it a character called Tachyon that sort of became High Father around that time, which confused me because he did, I think this Tachyon character showed up in some crossovers or something like that. But tell me a little bit more about Simonson's run on the New Gods. You enjoyed it, obviously?
Yeah, it was an Orion book, so it kind of... It's I guess a lazy comparison to say it was his way of doing Thor in DC because of that sort of father son relationship push and pull, but it's 25 issues, so it's nice and neatly told, and it's Orion coming face to face with Darkseid, defeating him, and actually cracking the code to the, what is it, Darkseid is always trying to
the anti-life
equation. Yeah, exactly. And I think Orion actually has it in his possession in the midway point of that book. I'd have to read it again, but you know, there's the Newsboy Legion is in it and all of it's pretty cool how it brings everybody into it in these small little snapshot stories, but an overall arcing story that ends quite nicely, where nothing is change to the point where you can't live with it, but it's a perfect omnibus. I feel it's one of those books where, you know, sometimes you get an omnibus in the middle of a run that was a great moment in that character's history, but then the before and after, this is just those 25 issues of Orion, that's it.
And it's self-contained, self-contained. I don't have to read it. Okay. I'll have to check it out at some point. It's always sort of been on my list because it did get a lot of critical acclaim at the time. And I do remember, I think I might have read like the first or second issue and then it just sort of, you know, fell out of my head. But if you recommend it, I will check it. Now, have you read Simonson's Ragnarok? I've heard a lot about that lately, his return to the Norse gods, essentially.
No, I haven't. I intend to. I'd like to because I love his stuff on Thor.
Absolutely.
The Marvel movies, I was never a huge Marvel fan in the way that I could, like if you look at my shelf now behind me, this is all a Marvel shelf here. This before it used to be, you know, maybe this much was Marvel. People can't see that I'm pointing to it, but reading his after the movies came out, and I didn't think Thor the Dark World was a great movie, but I liked the mythology of the Norse gods enough that I wanted to read a good, rich Thor story. And what was recommended to me was Jason Aaron at the time was starting his, you know, the God Butcher story was just coming out. So I was
brilliant, Rana.
Amazing, amazing. So I was reading that, and then I started picking up those trades of Thor, the Walt Simonson, that came in 5 trades, and I just was blown away by the amount of things he put in motion, Beta Ray Bill, the Ragnarok story, the you know, turning Thor into a frog, all of these places that he took me that were completely ridiculous but worked. And, you know, the
all splash page issue. Yeah. I think cartoonist Kayfabe recently did a flip through and I think it's part of the artist edition, but wow.
Yeah, just beautiful stuff. And then getting into realizing just what a wonderful tapestry the Marvel Universe was, especially, I mean, throughout every decade, there's something special about it, but a sweet spot for me is 80s comics with, now I'm halfway through the Thor volume, the Incredible Hulk, Peter David Omnibus volume 1. I'm just about halfway through that. And the deeper I go into the story, the more I'm invested, as opposed to sometimes you start, especially nowadays, we start series and the first issue has to be home run out the park, now I'm in. Whereas these were back then, it was a build, and then all of a sudden you're so invested in what these characters are doing. And back then, monthly, these kids were reading this stuff monthly, but reading it in this novel.
Oh, I was one of those kids.
Yeah. Just incredible stuff that was happening in that era. And, you know, from Thor to Roger Stern Spider-Man to Claremont with the X-Men, you like across the board, Daredevil, just firing on all cylinders. And the Marvel movies was what kind of opened me up to say, try reading more than just Superman, Batman, and the Justice League and Green Lantern. It doesn't suffer for some reason. The Marvel Universe doesn't suffer from the continuity somersaults that DC has to do. And I can't figure out how they pull it off.
I think it's just like whatever sort of doesn't work, they feel like they can just ignore that. I think, and that should be the way to go. You know, if it doesn't work, don't don't try to explain it away. Just let it quietly disappear, you know. And then someone will come along, like Al Ewing, who actually sort of does an amazing job of taking all these bits of sort of lost continuity and then weaving something incredible with it, like, pardon the pun. I can't remember. How far are you in Immortal Hulk right now?
I think I read the first 25 issues, so I'm behind.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, it'd be kind of fascinating to me because I did sort of jump back and read sort of certain key runs as they came up in the Immortal Hulk. How are you finding what you read of Peter David's run resonating with the Immortal Hulk? Is there anything sort of jumping out at you? Have you how far are you in Peter David's run? What's going on right now?
So I'm just finishing. I'm at 346. So the gamma bomb had just gone off in Middletown. I think it was
called. Okay.
So Quartermain is on trial, and I'm
okay,
so invested.
Okay, so it's
McFarlane. Yeah, it's the Eric Larson issue where just before Jeff Purvis comes on.
Okay.
So
gotcha.
Just seeing how at first it was like these kind of stories of the week following the Hulk kind of story, almost like the television show was, where he's mm-hmm. on the move, he's got Rick Jones with him, he's got this S.H.I.E.L.D. operative who's, you know, turned on S.H.I.E.L.D. and it's like, okay, I like this on the move sort of storyline, and you know that the monster's going to come out at some point and turn on his friends. But then to see how they tied the leader back into where he's just kind of slowly been featured in the issues, building up his plot, and seeing now where Betty's at and where Bruce is kind of that the psychological aspect of the Hulk. He's such an interesting character, probably one of the most interesting characters in comics. The more I read mm-hmm. the Hulk, I realize just how wonderful he is as a character. When you put him in, it's kind of like that argument people make about Superman, how he's lame because he's so strong and nothing can stop him. Mm-hmm. Well, the Hulk is sort of the same, but you give him supporting cast, and the weaknesses of him is his strength.
Mm-hmm.
And I love how Peter David was playing with that in what I'm reading so far. It's really good.
I think Peter David is sort of the watershed, especially since he played off of issue 313, which we've talked about. And I think it just recently got reprinted as the Immortal Hulk number 0. That sort of goes back and looks at Bruce's childhood, drawn by Mike Mignola and written / plagiarized by Phil Mantlo from, and actually, I don't know if you've seen the announcement, the original Barry Windsor Smith monster graphic novel has been solicited. So I cannot wait to read that as sort of the expanded Hulk story that we've been sort of waiting, the original version of Hulk 313 that Barry Windsor Smith intended to write and now has sort of expanded upon.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm very excited for you because I know in my mind that you're going to start getting into a lot of the, and it's not a spoiler to say that the Hulk, Peter David has written the Hulk as someone, back then the term was MPD, multiple personality disorder. I think it's now DID, dissociative identity disorder. And that's what Al Ewing is totally doing in his. So you reading these two books in parallel is absolutely perfect. And there'll be moments when you're like, oh, that's where that came from.
Yeah. And that was something I think it does make a difference when you read the, I don't want to say the correct run because everyone's got their favorite, but it kind of happened to me with reading the X-Men. I had read all kinds of X-Men here and there, key storylines. But when House of X came out, I said this before on the podcast, I went back and kind of tried to read a portion of the X-Men that was you know, missing in my mental library. So reading those stories like the Extinction Agenda and Fatal Attractions and, you know, even Fall of the Mutants, all of these things, seeing how they all integrate and manifest in these characters as the years go on, like nothing's left to waste. So when you kind of have that info. When I went back and read House of X as a hardcover, it resonated so much more, knowing where they're pulling certain things from, why that matters, why that character mm-hmm. would be feeling that way or whatnot. So yeah, it's true. When I was reading the Immortal Hulk, I thought this is just great storytelling, beautiful artwork, a perfect combination of Bennett, you know, and Al Ewing telling this story. You can tell that Al Ewing really wanted to write the Hulk.
Yeah, and Bennett's art is, you know, the body horror. And you'll see actually the body, again, I'm trying not to sort of spoil things, but you will see somewhat the origins of, like, Bennett has obviously taken it and like run all the way down the field with it, but you will see elements of the body horror in Peter David's run.
Yeah, yeah, I'm looking forward to it. One thing I want to ask you, we talk a lot about the metaphysics of comics and stuff. Who are some of those writers who you feel excel the most at using that element in their storytelling? Because I know you're a fan of that yourself, so you'd be somewhat of an expert in that topic, I think.
For me, and again, this is sort of, I don't know how much I've talked to you about St. Nella, the recent thing I'm sort of serializing in Cauldron, but St. Nella is sort of an actual character that I found sort of from a 17th century novel and realized she sort of recurs through history, real history, in terms of ballets, operas. I think I mentioned a Johnny Depp movie that Roman Polanski did, and I felt like, wow, I've just stumbled across a treasure trove, and I am taking a lot of what Alan Moore is doing in the pages of Promethea.
Okay.
And sort of, not to compare myself with, I'm definitely not, but I can see the influence there as I sort of write all these sort of different anthology style stories of St. Nella spread across time, with different artists, with different interpretations. How do I even begin to describe Promethea? Because this is the one that I want to recommend to you. On some levels, it's Alan Moore's Magic for Dummies.
Okay.
It's almost like an instruction manual on how Alan Moore views magic and functions as a magician, okay. A self-styled sort of magician. On the other hand, it is a terrific meditation on the act of creation itself, all within what on the surface would be a Wonder Woman pastiche. And I believe the origins of this sort of Promethea started. Are you aware of Alan Moore's work on Supreme?
I know his, I haven't read it, but I know his work on it.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that it's Alan Moore's love letter to Superman.
Okay.
Essentially. And there's a lot of, metaphysics in that, in terms of, the history of Superman and playing around and getting other artists to do sort of fake stories set in the 1950s or the 1970s or the Golden Age within the contemporary story of Supreme he's telling. And it was a very complex work at the time that was absolutely joyous for Moore. You can tell after sort of his disappointment as a self-publisher with a bunch of projects that didn't quite work, and then doing a lot of what I call paycheck comics that for Image, basically, his Violator, Spawn, Shadowhawk. He was doing a lot of these comics, and it wasn't as good as a lot of the stuff that Alan Moore, and knew his heart wasn't into it. And then suddenly he hit upon this pocket of nostalgia when doing Supreme. for Superman. And then he was going to continue that with Wonder Woman. Alan Moore had a very, very short-lived, I believe, I want to say, I can't remember who the artist was, but Glory. Do you remember that Rob Liefeld character called Glory? She was a Wonder Woman knockoff in the same way Supreme is a Superman knockoff. But he started two or three issues of Glory before the plug was pulled. And then he went over and did ABC. My recommendation to you, without sort of spoiling anything, is to find those. I don't know if it's available in Omnibus. The ideal reading would be the Absolute Editions, that are these huge volumes where you can see the J.H. Williams art. Both Moore and J.H. Williams have done a fantastic job. And essentially, there's four or five different versions of Promethea that kind of have recurred within his story. And they all sort of interact and intersect with the latest incarnation of Promethea. If ever there was a goodbye letter to comics, I think Promethea was Moore's goodbye letter to comics.
Okay. It's good to hear people's. You see these books on shelves, and you know obviously the name Alan Moore, it goes along with comic book excellence. But there's so many eras of these writers, similar to like a Grant Morrison or a Neil Gaiman, and you just don't know if you're heady enough yet to delve into it. And
it's a lot of work. Promethea, admittedly, is a lot of work, but well worth it once you sort of get into it and get going. And not to say it isn't an easy read, but just because you can sort of read it very breezily, you know, as just sort of the surface story. But once you sort of get into the depths of it, and Alan Moore actually starts teaching, like there's elements where you feel like he's teaching magic, and then you want to sort of get deeper and think about it more, or go read up on the concepts that he's introducing, or research Aleister Crowley, or you know,
have you done that after reading it? That kind of stuff freaks me out, I'm not gonna lie.
So really?
Like looking into someone like Aleister Crowley, or it's never been my cup of tea, but things like Moonshadow and Brooklyn Dreams from DeMatteis, and we were talking a little bit about, you know, the Jim Starlin, the psychedelic aspect of the storytelling, and knowing that these people were inspired by some type of substance when they were writing these, or inspired by it, because you see when you listen to people who have experimented with things, even, you know, musicians, everyone's experience is individual, but there seems to be a similarity in what they've tapped into. Mm-hmm. And you kind of see it in Moonshadow. Mm-hmm. Just the type of imagery that he's using to tell the story, and you see it in things that Morrison does, Alan Moore does. But then when you get into the more esoteric aspect of stuff a little deeper, like, that's the part where I'm like, oh boy, I don't know. I don't want to be hearing things go bump in the night.
No, it's not like that. Well, I think we've talked about this with Grant Morrison, especially. I think we've talked about like the Coyote Gospel, and then that the ending to his Animal Man and his Doom Patrol as well. Grant Morrison was straight edge back then. He had not yet started on his massive drug journey until I think around The Invisibles, and then that you can really, really sense him sort of going deep into the psychedelia of it all, you know what I mean? And I can totally see reading sort of Starlin comics from the 70s, just like you would read Steve Ditko's Doctor Strange. Not that I've done it myself, but I'm sure that would be really, really quite a quite a trip if you had dropped like LSD or done shrooms or some sort of hallucinogenic, you know?
Right.
In the case of stories about stories, you know, we're talking about sort of the metaphysics of it. I think I, especially you saying a moon shadow, again, I'm going to say go tackle Sandman next.
Yeah, tell me about Sandman, because I'm on the verge of pressing the order now button when it comes to the Sandman omnibus, because mm-hmm. there's anyone who's read it, review-wise, it's the high water mark of what comics could be.
Yeah.
You were saying that yourself. So I want you to tell me your experience with that book.
Again, it is sort of, you really find the voice of the writer. So Promethea is sort of really distilled Alan Moore, along with J.H. Williams too. You can't deny J.H. Williams as sort of the collaborator on Promethea, but in sort of the same way, Promethea is about stories and storytelling at its heart. Sandman is the same way, but in that kind of dark, whimsical way that Neil, I don't know if you've ever seen interviews with the way sort of Neil Gaiman speaks and the way he sort of tells stories. That's kind of how I look at Sandman. You know, it is sort of a manifestation, and maybe the first volume or two, Neil Gaiman is kind of brushing off the heavy Alan Moore influence on himself. Like, you really, really feel Moore's not voice, but Moore's influence. You know, Gaiman trying to be Alan Moore in those early issues, and then all of a sudden, especially once you get into the single issue one and done stories in Dream Country, I think in particular, or the issue that introduces death. Gaiman is finding his voice, and then it's a whole series again, because Sandman is the Lord of Dreams, this version of the Sandman, and as a result, the Lord, you know, in his realm is stories, and the way you look at stories and the way you sort of interpret stories. He created a story engine, essentially. He's created a world in which you can tell whatever story Neil Gaiman was feeling like telling. It's not like, in some ways, Cerebus the Aardvark, where Dave Sims said, I'm going to tell 300 stories about this aardvark, because at a certain point you realize Dave Sim, out of stubbornness, has really outgrown this aardvark character, and what he would really like to write is a biography of Oscar Wilde. So you've got this biography of Oscar Wilde sort of shoehorned into a volume of Cerebus, where Cerebus barely has a presence, for example, whereas Neil Gaiman has set up, you know, the world of dreams. And within that world, there's the main character of the Sandman, but often Sandman sort of falls into the background, and the other characters that populate his universe, which is, you know, as vast as the world of dreams, comes and goes into the forefront and background. Or it's more about sort of the relationships people have with the character of Dream, who's repressed, to say the least. You know, so you have a delightful contrast partway through, where it becomes almost like a road movie, you know, through the world of dreams and fantasy, where the Sandman goes on a road trip with his sibling Delirium, who's an absolute, basically his opposite in terms of personality, whereas he's sort of very sort of stodgy and unwavering. You know, she's nothing but unpredictable and mercurial, right, as I stumble with that word.
I love the concept of words and the personification of ideas.
Absolutely.
I love seeing that, because I feel, and it's not, this isn't an original idea of my own, but I kind of felt like that when, I think a big change for me was when I first time interviewed J.M. DeMatteis, and I read Brooklyn Dreams as some research, and it wasn't the type of book that I thought it would be, but it turned out to be everything I wanted it to be, as strange as that sounds. And it helped me to, it kind of just opened my eyes to somebody's autobiography that was, he put it, the way he explained it was, I had to lie to tell the truth.
It is memoir, but it's his emotional truth rather than the
fact,
you know, facts of the truth.
And it changed my how I looked at understanding the world in the differences between fact and truth, because oftentimes they're interchanged. So if you were to personify these things, these ideas like that, what would those characters be like? And I love seeing when people do it in music, and I love the idea of that, you know, with things as simple or as, you know, childish as what may have been, you know, the Infinity Gauntlet, the philosophy in the Infinity Gauntlet and the personification of death and what Thanos was trying to do. It's more than just a story of a twirling mustache bad guy.
Yeah, there's a love, it's oddly a love story,
right,
with him and death. Like, that's the fascinating part of it. And then you've read Death of Captain Marvel, right? We've sort of touched on this.
Yes.
What an unexpected start, because I honestly was, as a kid especially, with a title like Death of, you expect Captain Marvel to go out on a blaze of glory. Because as a kid, I would pick up, like, you know, Marvel 2-in-1, and it would be the Thing in Captain Marvel, and Captain Marvel would fly in with his cosmic powers and help Thing fight a supervillain. So what an unexpected, especially as Marvel's first graphic novel, it broke the rules. You know, Captain Marvel died of cancer, just like, and you know, had his emotional journey into accepting that.
Yeah. And it was, imagine as a kid reading that, and I think they called it the Black Death in that book, but realizing that no one escapes this eventuality, and how do you approach it? What do you do with it? How do you come to peace with that? And the whole, even in the early Captain Marvel stories where he's fighting Thanos in his mind, like, these concepts of the battles that are taking place are just so interesting. And you know, you see with the Infinity Gauntlet itself and how all the gems are representative of a certain realm and the power that they play in the universe. And then you see on the DC side of things, when Geoff Johns kind of did something like that with the willpower and all of the different spectra, the color and spectrums, like, it just kind of, within these pages of what people would consider, you know, cartoon stories, it adds, there's some sort of unveiling of what's happening on like a cosmic scale that we can't really explain in any other format in a way. So I always love seeing that happen and finding what other stories are accomplishing that. And like Planetary, that's another example of like story of stories that are just, you don't really get what's happening at first other than these clever one-shot stories. And then when it all ends and ties itself together, it's just incredible. The magic trick they pulled in a way.
No, so. Absolutely. Yeah. I would put, Planetary, Promethea, Sandman. These are all, auteurs, shall we say, exploring, the nature of story, reality, and to some extent genre. Now, do you have a favorite Starlin comic or series, a run, because you've all, like, did you read Starlin as a kid, or is this something you sort of recently started reading?
I read him in like portions of him throughout the years, like, you know, obviously his Batman stuff is well known as far as Death in the Family
the
goes.
The cult really sticks out in my mind as well.
Yeah, those ones are highly recommended books. And then of course Infinity Gauntlet, with everything that, especially when Marvel built a cinematic universe, out of all of the things that you would think, like, where might they go with this? Some people have mixed feelings about Infinity Gauntlet. Like, it's very 90s and you know, it's not as good as people make it out to be. It's kind of, but reading it and getting past bombastic aspect of an event book. I enjoyed that story. Cosmic Odyssey was another one.
Cosmic, yeah, that Mignola art too, and the New Gods. The New Gods, right there.
Yeah, the New Gods. I love that a lot. And then I went back and I read his Captain Marvel run, and I was surprised at how much it resonated with me, and so much of the stuff I don't understand, but I understand it. If that makes any sense. And whenever he gets into the realm of the, not, I don't know what the term is in the Marvel universe, but not the Eternals or the Celestials, but when he's, you know, you got Galactus speaking to the Living Tribunal.
Those higher planes of reality. The Living Tribunal and the In-Betweener and all these sort of cosmic entities that represent concepts.
I for some reason, it makes more sense to me than anything. I'm not sure why, but I kind of get what might be there. I don't know if that makes sense. It's like,
no, it does. It does. Cause, this is how people end up understand, you know, it helps people to understand if you anthropomorphize something,
right?
Shall we say, you give it a face and, it's an abstract concept that's sort of, this is sort of what Sandman and his siblings are, right? You've
right.
got Dream, who's walking, the walking manifestation of Death, who's not what you would expect. This is the wonderful thing to contrast sort of Marvel's Lady Death with Death with Sandman's sister, or Delirium, or they're all D names. Destiny.
Mm-hmm.
Go on.
No. It's one of those things where many people talk about Kirby and not liking Kirby until they're older, and then they realize. I feel like Kirby's brain was a universe.
Mm-hmm.
Inside that mind, and it was, people say, I remember Ty Templeton saying, you know, he wasn't the best speaker. He didn't communicate his thoughts in the most eloquent way, but inside that brain, he had a universe being created. And when see
visually,
what was existing in there, it was almost like insanity slash genius, right?
yeah, and Kirby is obviously a visual thinker,
right?
You know, he writes in pictures, which is why, you know, again, when he writes himself, there is a lot of sort of stilted dialogue, and he's not quite getting his point across. But boy, does he get his point across in his pictures,
yeah.
His visuals,
yeah. And I just like the concept of ideas being real things looking for a home to plant itself and come to life. And that often, you know, comes to life in a book, a story. But even though something's fiction and it's not, it didn't really happen to us or something that we have a photo of in our history, I almost feel like it's there somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it resonates with us so much. We can relate to it because they're just these things looking for places to come to life. So I'm always interested in hearing other places to kind of find that stuff where I won't get lost in the weeds, or it won't be over my head. So I'm definitely considering Sandman, because it was one of those books where I'm like, I'll never read it. I don't care. It's just too over my head.
Well, as you get older as well, your tastes sort of change and shift as well, right?
And
you read for different reasons as well. You know, I mean, I like to think of my tastes as very broad, and you know, it just depends on what mood. Sometimes I just want that Big Mac, right? And that's when I pick up my superhero, my standard mainstream DC Marvel superhero.
Yeah.
And then other times, you know, I really, really like, and Sandman is very literary in that there is a lot of references to, like, say, Shakespeare, for example. And it does help to sort of understand. I don't know if I've mentioned this to you. Every time there's a new version of Sandman over the years, I've kind of run out and bought. So I might own Sandman in like five or six different formats. But recently they came out with something called the Annotated Sandman within the last couple of when they came out with the Absolute Editions, I thought, I am never going to buy, you know, Sandman ever again. This is the ultimate, like, I have the Absolutes. They're big. their, you know, they slip case, they're beautiful paper, they recolored them. There's all sorts of extra material in here. And lo and behold, they came out with the annotated Sandman in yet another format. So I did need to get that. But I am getting sort of a lot of joy because I do get a lot of the references. But even, you know, I could go deeper into the rabbit hole of those references, right?
So yeah. And that, and I think that's the best part of even something like comic books that some people feel is, you know, disposable. There's so much reference to things that people, you're surprised at how much you accumulate, the knowledge you accumulate from reading comics through the decades, and the little pop culture references that they put in there that allow you now to, let me look that up. Let me figure out what that's referring to. And when you're able to read one thing, or even when you listen to podcasts, and you all of a sudden all these different authors and historical people, and you look them up, and you're learning beyond just what you thought you would realize. Instead of just, you know, this Green Lantern comic that you wanted to hear about, next thing you know, you're buying Teen Titans. Mm-hmm. And it's just this rabbit hole that you go down. And before you know it, you're reading a novel. I love that. So if Sandman does that, I'm all for it.
I'm trying to remember, as a kid, I think it was, the author's name was Piers Anthony. I read a couple of these books that just sort of speaking of manifestations of abstract concepts. And I think he had a novel series called Incarnations of Immortality, I want to say, where each novel sort of explored a different personification. So one guy, I think, accidentally kills death and has to become death. Or there's the concept of, I guess, time and war and evil and good. And I think... my memory of the... I had read a couple of them, but I think comics... are, you know, what we're talking about sort of draws on that a lot as well. And I have no doubt in my mind, for example, that Neil Gaiman would have, being a really well-read fantasy fan himself, would have, the Incarnations of Immortality would have influenced, you know, his Endless, for example.
Right. Well, it's going to be on the list then. I'm going to have to put it in the card and have it brought to the house soon. So before we wrap up, Sam, I want what are some of the things that you're working on? I always like to be able to promote what you've got going on so people listening to this episode, maybe listening to you for the first time, can know where to find your stuff.
We are working behind the scenes. We had the two back-to-back overlapping Kickstarters of Ballyskillen, the contemporary augmented reality fantasy series that we chatted with you about a couple of episodes ago. That and Cauldron Magazine, our anthology of horror with our friend Shane and Ricky and Casey. Those are actually on Indiegogo right now in demand. So if anyone missed the Kickstarter, they can just go over to Indiegogo and get some, not all, of the reward tiers that were offered. It's also, both are available for pre-order at RAID.world, which is the RAID Studios store. And I'm going to announce as an exclusive on your podcast coming up in January, we're launching a new, it's old material that we're repackaging in a collected graphic novel format. It's called Fandemic. Just sort of in honor of the times we live in. Fandemic is a collection of our pop culture comic strips that we, me and Dave Francioso and a few other friends like Jason Tokowitz and Matthew Tavares, did a few years ago that lampooned. It's sort of Mad Magazine in that it lampoons Star Wars and Batman and Doctor Who and Planet of the Apes, et cetera, et cetera. And we're going to have a new cover and add new material. So that will be dropping as a Kickstarter in January. In addition to that, we are re-serializing all the old content week after week. So if you're following us on like Twitter or Insta or Facebook, et cetera, even over at, we're going to try, what is it called? Webtoons. we're going to serialize over at Webtoon, so people can who aren't familiar with our comic series can re-experience that or experience it for the first time again with new material. So we've got a Mandalorian series of strips that I'm excited about because I crack myself up. So
this is all exciting. It is.
If I can sit there and make myself laugh, then hopefully I can send the script over to Dave, make him laugh, and then we send it out into the world and make everyone else laugh. So that's our goal in these troubled times. And obviously, we're having a little bit of fun. It's all in good humor. We realize, you know, the pandemic isn't necessarily a laughing matter, but calling it fandemic is just a fun pun that we're embracing.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't think there's anything more healing than laughter. And when you know, things may seem dire out there, everywhere you turn, you're just don't know what to do. You feel uninspired. Laughter is one of the most important things. So if the point of your project is to poke fun at the things that we love and laugh about them, there's healing power in that. So that's great. And I'm sure like all the other things you've been working on, you're the Kickstarter king now. If I got a Kickstarter I want to do, I'm going to come see Sam Noir and have him be a part of my project. That's good.
You're very kind. Thanks. And anytime you want to chit chat, hit me up. I'm your Huckleberry.
I love it. You know, I was saying to Shane that for a while I wanted, you know, as much as I could be able to talk to creators throughout the decades that I love and enjoy their work. But sometimes chasing after interviews can become a job in itself. But and I've made so many friends and have a camaraderie with all our local guys that, you know, every 2 months we could have a different guest on, or, you know, 3 times in a row have Sam Noir on, as long as the conversation is good and gets the juices flowing of what you want to read to dig into something, some content. That's all that matters. So I'm very happy that you've been able to come on these last 3 episodes. I appreciate it. It helped me get back into the podcasting groove, which is good.
Fantastic. I'm glad you're back, brother. Looking forward to seeing what's next. And just hit me up whenever. I'm game.
Awesome. Well, thank you again, Sam. And make sure everybody check out, what's the website again? Raidworld.com?
Yeah, raid.world.
Raid.world. You can find Shane's stuff there. You can find Sam's stuff there. Cauldron and all the stuff you guys are working on. All the other Raid artists that are absolutely incredible. So we will be back soon. Thank you once again, Sam Noir. And I hope everybody stays safe and stays healthy.